Hello and welcome to COVIDcast. My name is Hervé Lamieux and I'm the director of the Power and Diplomacy Program at the Lowy Institute in Sydney. As this crisis unfolds, we're sitting down with experts and policymakers from a range of fields to discuss the implications of COVID-19 for the world. In this episode, we are joined by the Honourable Malcolm Turnbull, 29th Prime Minister of Australia from 2015 to 2018. Mr. Turnbull, thank you for joining me.
Great to be with you, Hervé.
Now, you launched your long-awaited memoir in April this year in the midst of the pandemic, which was a logistical challenge. I found it a hugely absorbing book, and I think any fair-minded reader will agree it contains a good deal of truth about Australian politics and our place in the world. I would like to use that as a guide to understanding the challenges that Australia's leadership confronts today. I think you'll agree the pandemic has taken on a very divisive and geopolitical hue, but a lot of the antecedents of the deterioration in the US-China relationship, the collapse of multilateral consensus building, actually stems from an earlier period than the pandemic. And I think you presided over some of that and had to deal with a lot of those challenges. But at the same time, you were reluctant, I think, in your time in office and in the book, to characterize this as a new Cold War between the US and China. And I wonder whether you feel that you've changed your mind on that, whether the events of the way that history has accelerated through the pandemic lends itself to the theory that we are moving in the direction of a new Cold War, and what sort of wisdom you would counsel both China and the US, given the events of the last few months.
Well, look, I think historical analogies have got their uses, but they can be overused. And I really would discourage people from using Cold War terminology. I mean, China, Xi Jinping's China is not Stalin's Russia or even Brezhnev's Russia, or Soviet Union, I should say. So it's a very, I think the competition is accentuated. I think there has been a marked change on the part of the Chinese leadership to adopt a more aggressive approach internationally and a more assertive one. You know, and I compare in my book, that in the chapter about China, the way in which as recently as 2004, China settled boundary issues with Russia in a very pragmatic and sensible way. And you know, frankly, I don't think that Xi Jinping would do that today. That would be my judgment in the way that was done at the time. So, you know, China's assertiveness is, I think, in a sense, a response to domestic demands for China to, you know, play a part in the world commensurate to its economic achievements. Mm-hmm. I think the way in which they're going about it is, for the most part, quite counterproductive, because it is alienating countries when it should be seeking to befriend them. And, you know, the reality is that at the moment, the United States offers China a great opportunity. I mean, Trump's unpredictability, his inconsistencies, his, you know, inflammatory tweeting activities, his discombobulation of friend and foe alike, all offers the opportunity for China to be the anti-Trump and to be consistent where he is erratic, to be patient where, you know, he is impulsive, and generally to be seen as a steady, friendly, you know, a cuddly panda rather than a scary dragon. But they've chosen a course of action that I think is quite counterproductive. And of course, if the administration changes at the end of the year and you get a more conventional government, as you would under Biden, they may well have missed a historic opportunity.
Just to stick to China for 1 minute, in your book, at one point you describe, and I quote here, both President Xi and Premier Li are above all thoughtful technocrats, professional and pragmatic managers who are focused on outcomes. Is that still your reading of President Xi?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, he's one of the outcomes he's focused on is an expansion of both central and his own power over the country. I mean, the point I was seeking to make there was, well, I'll just go back a step. There is no inconsistency with saying someone is a technocrat and an authoritarian.
Yep.
I mean, there are plenty of technocratic authoritarians and authoritarian technocrats. But the point is that, you know, one of the reasons many people in China are not persuaded that democracy is something worth emulating or following is because they look at the United States and they say, well, you've had Barack Obama, who became the president with literally no experience in running anything. He had never run anything in his life, whether it was in business or in government. And then you have Donald Trump, who is a property developer, you know, with both successes and pretty spectacular failures behind him, and a reality TV show host. And then they say, on the other hand, you look at our leaders, and they are invariably technocrats. They're more often than not engineers. They've, you know, run. They've risen up through the hierarchy, like someone would rise up through a big, you know, multinational. You know, running a little business and a bigger business, and then finally getting the top job. And that is, you know, one of the big differences. Now, China could play that, use that to their advantage if they chose to. But instead, you know, we're now getting all this blustering, threatening language, both from their diplomats and their state-owned media.
Absolutely. And it does seem as if they've committed a series of missteps here. And I think it speaks to the fact that I think it's not just the United States, but it's also China that will emerge diminished from this global crisis.
To be honest with you, Hervé, I have to say, look, you may be right. I'd obviously, China mishandled it at the outset. There's clearly, you know, plenty of evidence for that. But bureaucratic denial of, you know, an unwillingness to acknowledge a disaster was looming is not unique to the Chinese system.
Mm-hmm.
What has been catastrophic has been the inability of the United States to deal with it. You know, that is the and you could make a similar comment about the UK to some extent, but boy, you know, the failure of the richest, most technologically advanced country in the world to be able to deal with this is staggering. And you know, that is it goes to the very heart of people's confidence in the United States. I mean, so many Americans must now be saying, why, what has gone wrong with our government that we cannot deal, you know, with basic things like personal protective equipment, testing, you know, a consistent message on social distancing and so forth. I mean, it's tragic.
Do you worry that the Trump administration has done permanent damage to the fabric of American democracy, to the strength and resilience of its institutions? And what sort of America will emerge from this pandemic and perhaps even from a Biden victory in November?
Well, look, I mean, the United States has endured greater challenges than Donald Trump. I mean, the two world wars and indeed a civil war, you know, just three examples. But Trump seeks to divide and exploit the divisions of American society. In that respect, he is the antithesis of what you expect from a national leader. A national leader is expected, particularly in a country that is diverse and a multicultural country like the United States or Australia, their aim should be to unite, to bring people together. It's, you know, what I used to talk about all the time. Now, Trump has a very different approach. He sees the divisions and he seeks to exploit them to his own advantage. Now, that is damaging American society. America will be more polarized and more divided after 4 years of Trump, assuming we only have 4 years. Is it going to be a permanent impairment? Well, I hope not. But America has to address a lot of challenges. Racism, which has been the focus of the Black Lives Matter movement in recent times, is one. But linked to that, of course, is economic inequality. The flatlining and indeed decline in some sectors in real terms in, you know, middle-class incomes and working-class incomes in America poses a major challenge. I mean, the whole sort of proposition of America was an open society, upward mobility, the place where you can realize your dreams. If people feel it cannot deliver that, then that is undermining the whole raison d'etre of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
as a society, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I mean, that's what it was all about. So people have got to feel that they've got a fair crack of the whip and they can get on with it. Now, the other thing that has been, and, you know, Tom Friedman wrote a very good book about this not so long ago, has been the extraordinary neglect of public services, not just in terms of health and education and so forth, but also in infrastructure. You know, it is, I mean, it is American infrastructure, by and large, is an embarrassment. Everyone acknowledges this, but where is the leadership to get it fixed? And of course, you know, frankly, the new administration, the administration, is going to have a big opportunity to really get in and spend a lot of money on infrastructure. You know, if ever there was an opportunity for a new deal, ideally a Green New Deal, it is now.
We'll come to the Green New Deal in a moment, but I thought I would shift gears and ask you about some of your thoughts about other world leaders that you mentioned in your book. On the whole, I think you have mostly warm views of your counterparts on the world stage. There are a few humorous anecdotes here and there and an occasional disparaging remark. I recall you writing about Duterte's outbursts, we'll kill them all, when he was referring to, or I killed them all, rather, when he was referring to his time as a mayor and drug traffickers, an incredulous reaction by Li Keqiang. There was the fact that Trudeau had asked you to compliment his socks, I believe, on the sidelines of a Vietnam summit when he was a sort of...
Well, he invited a comment on his socks. I assume he expected a compliment.
And at the same time was sort of derailing the signing of the TPP-11 in Vietnam. So that, I think, got on your nerves a little bit. And of course, more humorously, Macron complimenting your wife, Lucy Turnbull, as délicieuse in French, delicious in English, but he meant delightful. But anyway, so yeah. Humorous anecdotes aside, I think I wanted to focus mostly on your relationship with Narendra Modi in India and Jokowi in Indonesia, because it strikes me these are the two most consequential partnerships for Australia outside of the US alliance framework. So if you know, Japan would also be an ally of the US. Certainly in our sort of multipolar in the Pacific region. And it strikes me that you had much more to say about Jokowi, perhaps because you spent more time with him. And you concluded the chapter on him by saying he really is the hope of the side. And A, is that still your assessment of Jokowi now that he's slightly further along into his term? But then also in terms of the comparison with Narendra Modi, it was interesting that you presented Modi as a more complicated figure, both as a reformer, someone who was looking to the future as a modernizer, but also someone who looked to the past and to an imagined glorious past of Hindu nationalism. And I think there were some sort of undertones there of basically a more complex relationship with India and a more uncertain future for the rise of that great power. I don't know whether I'm misreading you or reading too much between the lines.
I think that's a good review. Look, the Indonesian relationship is by far the most consequential in the region at the present time. They're our closest neighbor. You know, we have a massive, vital, vested interest in deepening and strengthening our relationship with Indonesia. And Jokowi is the hope of the side. He is the leader of the world's largest majority Muslim nation, and maintaining Indonesia, despite the pressure from, you know, fundamentalists and Islamists and groups, maintaining Indonesia as a secular society, where, as he says, they can demonstrate that democracy, moderation, and Islam are compatible. That is of such importance in the world. So I put a lot of effort into the Indonesia relationship, and I think when I left government, our relationship was at the strongest and best it has ever been. I think most observers would agree with that. Mm-hmm. India is very underdone from our point of view. I think it's largely our fault, to be quite honest with you. You know, and it's, but having said that, India is protectionism is in their DNA. It may be a big noisy democracy, you know, where English is widely spoken and British institutions are very familiar. But nonetheless, their instincts are protectionist and, you know, that is why we don't have a free trade agreement with India.
Mm.
And, you know, India wasn't even prepared to sign up to RCEP, for heaven's sake, which is probably the most low ambition trade agreement Australia signed up to in many, many years. The only reason Australia signed RCEP was because, you know, it would have been a bad look diplomatically not to. It literally was, it is a very low ambition, old-fashioned trade, not in the same planet, not in the same solar system as the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Anyway, India, I think it's got to be a very high priority. We've got a number of good assets, angles with India. Obviously, above all, is the large Indian diaspora in Australia. You know, there's an increasing number of Australians, you know, who hail from either first or second generation or longer, in fact, from India. And that is a huge opportunity. And of course, we've got generally educated people in India speak English. So that's a big plus. And of course, we've got a lot of cultural commonalities, including cricket.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're right about Modi. I mean, Jokowi is, he seeks to unite Indonesia, right? He is very, very much committed to the secular vision of Indonesia as, you know, this gigantic archipelago with people from many backgrounds and many ethnic groups and languages, but bring them all together, you know, and that is, he's a great unifier. Modi, on the other hand, has and this is his whole background, you know, he has a very Hindu vision of India. You know, he has used the division or the antagonisms between Hindus and Muslims to his political advantage. And of course, you know, he's been, you know, the subject of, you know, trenchant criticism around the world and indeed in India for doing that. But it's a very different view. I mean, India is unique, right? It's and, you know, it's often compared to China because they're roughly the same population size. But, you know, China is a much, much more homogenous society than India. I mean, there is one national language in China. The population is overwhelmingly Han Chinese. Yes, there are plenty of minorities in China, but, you know, they represent collectively less than 10% of the total population. India is a much, much more complicated country, you know.
Mm.
As someone said once, I think an improbable nation and an unlikely democracy. And that's really their great achievement, that they've been able to do that. I mean, India is an extraordinary accomplishment to literally have that nation united despite the tensions that I adverted to a moment ago, but also as a democracy.
Mm. Let's come back to Australia. I've detected a shift in emphasis or a way of thinking about Prime Minister Morrison's view of multilateralism, global institutions. If you compare his speech less than a year ago at the Lowy Institute, in which he spoke of negative globalism, to which he was referring to an unaccountable internationalist bureaucracy, and then, for example, Foreign Minister Maurice Payne, who was defense minister under your government, her speech a few weeks ago, which sounded far more constructive in terms of the need to not yield sovereignty, but share a portion of sovereignty in the mutual interests of different countries to achieve common objectives. Have you detected a change in tone and approach as well?
Scott Morrison had little or no interest in international affairs before he became Prime Minister. That's the first point. I think early in his time as PM, he was unduly influenced by people on the right of politics, both in his own circle and in the media, and, you know, to whom this sort of UN bashing, anti-globalist thing is bread and butter. I mean, Trump, it's the same sort of stuff Trump goes on with. And I think that was a speech that Scott gave, I suspect, that was represented the views of other people and not his own. It sounded utterly unlike him to me, and I've worked with him for many years.
Mm.
You know, that is, maybe it's Andrew Shearer, maybe it's, you know, trying to curry favour with the leader writers, the Australian, I don't know. And you know, and of course it became an embarrassing absurdity so quickly, because the one thing that when you're presented with a pandemic, is that you need is global organizations working well, and you've got to improve them. So Maurice is much more on message, both in a traditional sense, and I think, you know, I don't think you'll hear any more of negative globalism from Scott. I think, you know, there it is. It was early in his days. If I could just make this point, and I make this point in my book, if you look at America's position in the world today, it has less influence than it did before Trump. One of the reasons is because it's pulled out of so many of these international organizations or stepped back from them, you know, whether it's the Paris Treaty, you know, or stepping, you know, trying to walk away from trade agreements and so forth. On the other hand, look how skillfully China has used organizations that are setting international standards like the ITU to set standards, technical standards that suit its purposes. So you know, it's all very well to say globalism is bad, but we do have global standards. We need global organizations. You know, that's the bottom line. And from Australia's point of view, as a middle-ranking country, we are far better off being actively engaged and making sure we have a voice in those global institutions. Otherwise, it's a case of out of the room, out of the deal. And I think yes, we should argue for reform of, you know, the World Health Organization or the, you know, UN or whatever. By all means, we should do that. But you can only do it if you're actually engaged, and you've got to put the resources and the time and the commitment in to make it done.
When you think to the measures you undertook to bolster the resilience of Australian institutions from foreign influence, from cyber intrusions and espionage, freezing out Huawei from the 5G market, which looks very prescient in light of the UK's decision just in the last 24 hours, it's clear you undertook some real robust measures in relation to China. But at the same time, I wanted to go back to something you'd written, not in this book, in a review of Hugh White's book in 2012, The China Choice, where you said, we should seek to ensure that the Americans, unlike the Spartans, do not allow their anxiety about a rising power to lead them into a reflexive antagonism that could end in conflict. When you consider some of the rhetoric, particularly on the backbench, we have the Chinese wolf warriors, and you have the Australian Wolverines. Do you think that they are in danger of perhaps making this mistake?
Well, yeah, but their backbench is seeking attention. You know, that's they're trying to get their faces on the news, and you know, they want to be talked about. So that's what backbenchers often do. I mean, ideally, you do it in a way that is going to be more productive. I think a lot of that rhetoric is ill-judged. You know, I think you can demonstrate a determination to stand up for Australia's sovereignty in a calm and measured way. So, look, it's just we have a rowdy democracy, Eva, as you know, and so people will often say things in Parliament that are more exaggerated or hyperbolic in order to get attention. So I think everyone can understand that you need to dilute that a little bit.
So it's all part of the democratic process, and it's culturally ingrained in the...
Yeah, well, it is a colourful process. But the critical thing is that when you are dealing with imperial powers, whether they are in Washington or Beijing, to remember that in the capital they regard deference as their due. So you don't get any extra marks by being a sycophant. What you need to do is to stand up for your position consistently, speak respectfully, there's no point being scratchy or abusive, but stand your ground. And I think I demonstrated that my government did, and Morrison is demonstrating that his government is. The alternative is just one where you will end up being pressured into a position of compliance. I mean, we don't want to play Finland to China's Russia.
So you see more continuity in present government's handling of the China challenge than you see rupture in terms of your own...
Oh, yeah, I think I can't see any difference at all to be at this stage. I mean, I think Morrison's remarks about an investigation into the origins of the virus, I mean, the timing of it was perhaps just a bit unfortunate because it followed after some pretty inflammatory remarks of Trump. But at the end of the day, the fault of that fracas was entirely in Beijing. I mean, you know, you have a global pandemic and the Australian Prime Minister says we need to have a thorough inquiry into its origins and how it was managed and so forth. I mean, the response in Beijing should have been, yes, of course we'll have an inquiry. We thoroughly support one and we'll cooperate with it. I mean, if a bridge falls down and someone says we should have an inquiry, is that something to be remarkable? China overreacted to what Scott said and as a result made themselves the issue, whereas in fact that was a ball in a cricketing term that China should have just allowed to go straight through to the keeper, not responded to it other than to say, we welcome an inquiry and we'll be working with the World Health Organization to ensure it's a thorough going one. But if you try to present an inquiry as being something to go and look for the guilty people, which is what Trump's obviously trying to distract attention from his own failures, obviously it won't be effective. The inquiry's got to be on a sort of no blame, no shame basis. You know, you've got to say right at the outset, listen, there's no question plenty of mistakes have been made.
Yep.
And plenty of good decisions have been made too, but let's find out what happened, where it happened, who did what, when, and so forth. And the interesting thing is, I mean, yes, let's assume the virus, don't think there's any doubt that it began in Wuhan and spread from there. But when you look around the world, you've got a number of different models of different countries have handled it in different ways. And there is actually, I think, in many respects, more to learn from the responses to the virus than we will learn from its origins.
Mm-hmm. The global politics are almost worse than the pandemic itself. The health outcomes were exacerbated as a result of the politics.
You see the dangers of right-wing populism. The same right-wing populists who deny the science of climate change have been out there denying the reality of the virus.
And that's exactly where I wanted to lead you next, actually, just on the idea of climate change, because it seemed to me that the horrid bushfires we had last summer looked like the kind of national crisis that Australia needed to finally shake itself from its climate malaise. Perhaps that's overly optimistic, but the pandemic then came along and I think environmental concerns have once more taken a backseat if you look at Lowy Institute polling. But as you've pointed out, COVID and the pandemic and its global economic implications need not be something that we present in opposition to climate action. In fact, there is no returning to a pre-2019 world, economically speaking. We're going to need to do some form of stimulus that may be parlayed into better climate policy. I mean, this is something that the Europeans are doing. Do you think that the Morrison government needs to embrace a more ambitious set of targets, a more integrated climate policy into its economic recovery plans?
The answer is yes, of course I do. I mean, we need an integrated national climate and energy policy. I mean, we had one with the National Energy Guarantee, but that was abandoned by Morrison. So, you know, Scott has to grapple with the same toxic politics as I did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that there is toxic troika of, you know, right-wing populism, climate denial, the right-wing media, particularly Murdoch's media, which has been an absolutely malign force in this area, both in Australia and the US in particular. And of course, the fossil fuel lobby, whose interests are the most easy to understand of the three. But it's diabolical because, you know, we have an opportunity to have greener and cheaper energy, and we are making progress, but it is slower and more difficult because of the poisonous politics.
Mm. Coming to the Pacific step up, which is something that you take great pride in as something that you started under your premiership, do you think that Australia's climate policies are at risk of undermining, perhaps fatally, the credibility of Australia in the South Pacific, in the Pacific Islands?
Yeah, the answer is, I don't know whether fatally is the right term, but yes, they certainly undermine it. I mean, if you're in the Pacific, climate change is a very existential issue. I mean, in some cases, you know, you're talking about islands which will basically be rendered uninhabitable by rising sea levels. So yeah, I mean, I think Australia's record on climate is a huge negative for us in the Pacific. And you know, it's not just the very small island states. I mean, you take Frank Bainimarama of Fiji. I mean, he's been a very vocal critic of Australia, and you could never, you know, you couldn't accuse Frank of being a, you know, latte sipping lefty greenie from the inner city. You know, I mean, he's a Fijian naval officer, and I mean, he's a very tough guy, and he's just very hard headed and practical about it. And he's living there. He sees it. You know, climate change can, as I say in my book, it's a matter of politics in Australia all too often. In Pacific, it's life and death.
Mm-hmm. Leads to very different assessments of what security challenges ought to be prioritized. I think there's a misalignment of expectations. But moving on, when it comes to allegations that DFAT has been somewhat neglected within the hierarchy of government in terms of static funding, the aid budget flatlining, if we're facing an increasingly challenging strategic environment, do we need to be doing more in terms of beefing up our diplomatic muscle as well as our defense capacities, our long-range missiles? Or do you think that that's something that is a concern that's overplayed?
No, I think we need to improve both the quantity and above all the quality of our diplomatic efforts. Mm-hmm. It's critically important, really vitally important. But I emphasize the quality. I mean, the difference between having one ambassador is not the same as another ambassador. You need to have the right people in the right place, and selecting your international representatives is critically important.
Mm-hmm. And then I like the distinction you make in terms of saying that you've always characterized your career in politics as the pursuit of power for purpose. And then you also complain that much of the way that politics is covered in the media nowadays is as sport almost. And it strikes me that's not just an Australian phenomenon, that many politicians the world over have little interest in the complexity of what I would call purposeful politics. Instead, they offer their supporters sort of the red meat of gladiatorial combat. Brexit isn't a good example of that. And I think the onset of COVID-19 has probably reminded us of the need for an alliance of politics with ideas, with purpose, with expertise, both domestically and globally. So do you have any hope for your brand of centrism, the small L liberalism coming back, making a resurgence, not just in Australia, but also in the broader West?
Well, I think the answer is I do, but it's quite beleaguered at the moment. I mean, the smaller liberals are very beleaguered within the Liberal Party, which has moved further and further to the right, particularly after my departure, you know, and the departure of Julie Bishop and Christopher Pyne, among others. I think that is a good, progressive, centrist, smaller liberal government is what Australians like and what they need, what the country needs. It's the right sort of mix of practical political philosophy that the country needs. I think the biggest challenge we've got at the moment is not from the left. I think it's from right-wing populism. And I mean, you know, you've only got to look at Trump as a good example of that. I mean, it is and you know, the dangers of this right-wing populism are so manifest. I mean, look at Brexit, for heaven's sake. I mean, just think about it. The United Kingdom has chosen at a time of rising protectionism to leave the largest free trade zone in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how can that not be anything other than nuts? And yet they're doing it. And boy, that is, it's just hard to see. There'll always be an England, et cetera. But boy, it's hard to see how that isn't a massive own goal. And you see, there is a petulance on the right wing of politics. And you see this with Trump again, and Brexit was an example of this. And this is not just leaders. This is in the air. This is in the community, in the zeitgeist. Just because an international body or an agency of some kind is not entirely acting to your satisfaction, you want to just walk, you know, pick up your toys and leave. Well, you know, maybe you were better off sticking around and working harder to make it work well.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a saying, out of the room, out of the deal, is a very wise one.
Mm.
Look at the humiliating, embarrassing sort of twists and turns of Britain's policy on 5G and Huawei. I mean, it was obvious that Britain should have made the same decision we did, which was to say, we won't have any high-risk vendors in our 5G. Sorry, you know, nothing personal. This is just prudent, you know, risk management.
Mm.
you know, and look at the way we did our research, we did our analysis carefully, confidentially, made the announcement, no further correspondence entered into. That was it. Britain's been through this whole tormented political turmoil. Why? Why? Because they didn't want to offend China because they were vulnerable on trade. That's why.
Mm-hmm.
So the price of leaving Brexit, of Brexit rather, was that they were making decisions, now happily reversed, that would have exposed them to considerable risk in, from a security point of view, from Beijing.
And undermined their sovereignty, which was the opposite point of Brexit.
I know.
The ironies.
That's the thing we've got no shortage of at the moment.
Mr. Turnbull, thank you. You've been very generous with your time.
Thanks, Eve.
Thanks again for joining me today for what has been a rich discussion on your book, A Bigger Picture, as well as on Australia's foreign policy challenges in the post-COVID-19 world. I want to thank my colleague, Jennifer Reinhardt, for your assistance in the production of this episode. Please keep an eye out on our social media channels for details of the next episode in the series. You'll also find all the previous episodes of COVIDcast on the homepage of our website.